I'm Kate, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM, Eager.
101.1 FM is owned and operated by the Independence Foundation Trust as a nonprofit community service.
You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper, the man William Jefferson named as the most dangerous radio host in America. Or whatever that's worth. It's true, though. To the communists and socialists who have infiltrated and are now in control of our government, truth is the most dangerous weapon that they face, and that's what we deliver on the Hour of the Time. For those of you who may have missed us yesterday because we were 16 minutes getting up on the satellite, the reason why is daylight savings time. We don't have it here in Arizona. Therefore, we did not even know it was going to occur. We're not interested in it. It's not in our newspapers. It's not on our radio. We don't see it on television. Nobody announces it. Nobody in town talks about it. It just snuck up on us. And if it hadn't been for Monty from Radio Free Vermont, wanting to know where our broadcast was so that he could air it on his affiliate station, we would never have known, ladies and gentlemen. So that's what happened anyway. Also, there's something else that you all need to know because it's going to affect all of you. As of the 30th of April will be the last day that Swiss America Trading sponsors the Hour of the Time. And the reason is lack of listener support. And I've warned you about this on many occasions. I told you a long time ago that if you did not support Swiss America Trading for sponsoring this broadcast, that someday they would no longer be able to do it. It's not cost effective. It costs an awful lot of money, ladies and gentlemen, to pay for the airtime on shortwave radio and satellite for a two-hour broadcast each day. Now, if you don't believe that, you call the satellite uplink people and ask them how much they will give you a satellite spot for 2 hours, 5 days a week, and then call all the different shortwave stations and ask them for their prices to air a two-hour broadcast 5 days a week per month. And you're going to find out that Swiss America Trading has been putting an awful lot of money to keep this broadcast on the air, even long beyond the point where it was profitable, simply because Craig Smith has always believed in what I'm doing and in the message of this broadcast. I'm going to read you the letter that he sent to me so that you'll understand what's going on here. It's from Swiss America Trading. Dear Bill, I have attempted to reach you a number of times recently and have been unsuccessful. Enclosed, please find a copy of the recent marketing data that, to say the least, is quite disturbing. Ever since your departure from WWCR, our numbers have progressively fallen. A substantial amount of time has passed since the program has been cost-effective from an advertising standpoint. However, you know that I believe in you, your message, and the need of the American people to hear, and thus I have continued to support your efforts. And that is true, folks. He goes on, therefore, unless something substantially changes, I cannot foresee Swiss America Trading Corporation being in the position to continue to advertise on your program. I will continue through the month of April with our final broadcast day to be April the 30th, 1997. Believe me when I tell you, Bill, this is not an easy decision in light of the years we have been together. However, the numbers simply do not justify our continuing. As the steward of this company, I am accountable to spend every dollar effectively and to the benefit of the corporation. In closing, if you can see a way to continue our relationship in a mutual benefit fashion Please call me to discuss future plans. Sincerely yours, Craig R. Smith, President, Swiss America Trading. Now, it's not just a failure to support Swiss America Trading, ladies and gentlemen. This tells me that you're not doing anything to help yourselves either, and that's even more dismal than losing our sponsor, because this broadcast has always been here for the purpose of awakening the American people, educating them, and helping them to prepare for what is coming, and what is coming is not going to be pretty. And if you're not prepared for it, you're going to go down the tube so fast you won't even know it happened until you find yourself with nothing, sitting in a ditch in a rainstorm, wondering how you're going to feed, shelter, and clothe, and provide security for your family. Unless you have the means to do that, you're just going to be another refugee in a long line, or a dead body lying beside the road, and I don't want to see that. Now let me give you the numbers that he's talking about. He's talking about these numbers go back to September of 1996. In September of 96, there were 16 people who called Swiss America Trading who said that the source of their information was this broadcast, and four of those purchased precious metals. In October of 96, 12 called, one purchased. November 96, 17 called, one purchased. December 96, 11 called, one purchased. January 97, 16 called, one purchased. February 97, 10 called, none purchased. And so far, March 97, 3 called, none purchased. Ladies and gentlemen, that's dismal. It tells me that you really don't give a damn about this broadcast, except for those very small percentage of people who have always supported us and have probably been the ones who have made these purchases here. You really don't care about the broadcast. You don't care about the fact that Swiss America Trading has sponsored this broadcast for the last 5 years and has been over backwards to make sure that we stayed on the air, even though it was a losing proposition for them, lost all the liberal and socialist customer base that they could have had by sponsoring this broadcast. And folks, it also tells me that you really don't care about yourselves, because you're not purchasing the gold and silver coins that you're going to need to survive a collapse of this system that we're in right now, which is going to collapse, folks. Whether you want to accept that or not, I'm telling you right now, and you know that every prediction that I have ever made, ladies and gentlemen, has come true, except the one that I made that said Manuel Noriega would not be tried or convicted in an American court of law simply because he had immunity as the head of a foreign nation. It's called diplomatic immunity. You can't go to France and kidnap the president, bring him back here, and try him for anything. It's an act of war. It's against the law of nations. But you see, at that time, I did not realize that the New World Order had progressed as far as it has, and that the military forces of the United States are actually functioning as the police force for the New World Order. There is, in fact, ladies and gentlemen, according to treaties and interpretation of the law and of Article 6 of the Constitution for the United States of America and the United Nations Charter and all the conventions and resolutions and treaties pursuant thereto, there are no more sovereign states in this world, regardless of what you may be told. It is a fact. And since I made that prediction and found out I was wrong, I did the research and revealed what I have just told you on the air here, documented it, and sourced it. Now, to bring about the New World Order, they have to destroy the existing order. And if it's going to be a socialist totalitarian world government, they must eliminate the middle class, which means this economy has to come tumbling down. They have set us up for it. It's going to happen. You failed to support our sponsor. You failed to protect your assets with gold and silver coin, which means that I don't know why you're listening to this broadcast. Obviously, you're not looking up the documentation and the sources that we give you, and you don't believe what we're telling you. Because if you did, they would have been swamped with customers preparing for what we all have proven and documented and sourced on the air is coming. So So when it happens, folks, I've done everything I can for you. I can't do any more. And I will persevere as long as I can. But I'm going to tell you, the broadcast of the hour of the time is going to be severely cut back. Severely cut back. Shortly after the 1st of May, we will go back to 1 hour a day instead of two. And within a short period of time after that, we're going to cut down on the number of days that the hour of the time will broadcast, unless I can find another sponsor in the meantime. And I am looking. Because we just simply can't afford to put these costs for ourselves. If necessary, I'll go back to one night a week, like I started with when I was paying for my own broadcasting, and I can afford that. But that's about all that the trust can afford. The trust actually owns this broadcast, Harvest Trust. Harvest Trust owns the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network. As long as we can continue to increase the number of broadcasters on the network will be viable. But the other broadcasters don't pay for this broadcast, you see. So that's what you can look forward to. And, you know, what can I say? Being truthful with you, as always. Don't go away. I'll be right back after this very short pause, folks. And get pen and paper. Be prepared to take notes. And in the second hour, we will air part two of the occult history of the Third Reich. I've got something to read to you now, folks, and I am impressed with this. It's entitled On the Day I Die by Deborah Marie Pulaski as told to Claire Wolfe. And I'm going to read it to you just exactly like it is written. This week, I learned I'm dying. Of course, I've always known in the everyday human sense that I was going to die. But this week I learned I am going to die soon. In a year or so at most, I won't be on this planet. No more breathing. No more Zinfandel or chocolate cake. No hugs. No sorrows. I won't ever again have to worry whether there's a run in my stocking when I go to a meeting with the boss, or whether I remembered to send a birthday card to my best friend's husband. It's a peculiar thought, looking at my own death so close, but you know it isn't a bad thought, all things considered. I'm 53 years old. That isn't old. I might have had another 30 years if one little cell hadn't decided to start mutating out of control a while back. But 53 is old enough to have lived a good life. It's long enough to have become a full person without all those who am I's and What do I want to do with my life that make youth so overrated? It's enough time to have loved, both in the frantic, desperate way of being young and in the comfortable way of being an adult. That's been an amazing and a very happy transition. But I don't want to talk about love. I want to talk about freedom. Well, I guess that means I do want to talk about love, because I love freedom more than I love anything. Really, more than I ever loved my husband. Even more than I love my kids, and I think they'll understand and forgive me for saying so, even though that statement might require a little more explaining for strangers who might be reading this. I have to say it again. I love freedom more than I love anything. More than I ever loved anything. And that's what makes the thought of dying so bitter, and at the same time, so welcome. I guess that idea is going to take some explaining, too. Claire, tell them about me. I've never been able to write or even talk all that well about things that matter to me, so you tell people what kind of person I am. Make them understand. I've always been a political junkie. You know me. Like some women's shop, I do politics. No, that isn't putting it right. Not at all. I do politics. I guess I'd better say I used to do politics, because I couldn't stand still and let them take away our world. You know the types who aren't happy unless they're running other people's lives. When I ran into a neighbor, co-worker, or family member like that, I could just say, sayonara, baby, and avoid them. But the people who really got to me were the ones who wanted to make endless rules for the whole country, the whole world, and make everybody else obey them, just obey all the time. I swear, you know, that these people don't even care what the particular rules are. They just like making and enforcing rules because. For the power. For the control. For their other powerful controlling friends, so they can all feel important and be in charge. So I always had to try to stop these people, but there wasn't any stopping them. I found that out. God, I wish I were a writer like you, or a great orator, or a wizard about the law, or something like that. I wish I could have done something big during my life. But you know me, I was never anything but a little precinct worker, a drone, a little deputy voter registrar, doorbeller, meeting attender, envelope licker. One of those women you see in every campaign and every organization, never getting noticed and never particularly wanting to be. Just wanting to make the world freer, or at least keep a little bit of the world away from the people who want to make it less free. It was really kind of stupid looking back on it, because nearly all of the people who said they believed in freedom turned around and, once they got in office, acted exactly like the other guys. They didn't really want less government and more freedom. They just wanted to be the ones in control. But I just had to try, didn't I? Anyway, I did try, just about all my life. God, that expression, just about all my life, has a different ring all of a sudden. It really has been just about all my life. Will be just about all my life. I wanted freedom so much. I wanted it just so that I and my kids could live an ordinary life, making a living, paying our way, doing what we wanted to do within the bounds of polite behavior to our neighbors, just to live without being ordered around, threatened or tangled up in red tape every time we tried to do something. I didn't have any spectacular ambitions. I just wanted to be let alone, to live a peaceful life. I have two daughters, you know. They're both in their early 20s right now. The youngest one, Edie, was always a dreamer. She had all the ideas and ambitions I didn't care to have. I remember as a little kid, she swore she was going to go live on Venus someday. Then, when she learned Venus was really this awful place, she pouted for about 2 days and then switched to Mars. She figured we could colonize Mars. And I don't know whether that's realistic or not, but I always wanted to see Edie get the chance to try, if that's what she wanted to do. I wanted her to have the chance to try anything her wild little imagination could dream up. Maybe she'd fail, but maybe she'd succeed. And isn't that what keeps the human race moving? Edie, impossible though she can be at times, is the kind of person who keeps the human race from sitting on its dead butt going nowhere. But Edie isn't going to have the chance unless something comes out of the blue to turn things around. Edie's never going to get to Mars. Heck, she isn't even going to get a chance to build a little earthbound business because she's too independent to jump through all the hoops the government requires. Yeah, I can just see my Edie filling out forms in triplicate, collecting taxes from her employees and begging for government licenses. Not! She isn't going to get a chance to make many personal choices beyond what brand of soap or TV to buy, because our choices are being limited day by day, and everywhere you turn, you run into something illegal. Maybe even something that was legal yesterday, but is illegal today, thanks to some regulation nobody ever heard of. She just won't put up with that, but I don't know what she'll do instead. I used to dream, as I worked on all those campaigns, that someday I'd win back the right for Edie to have the risky, but hope-filled future she craved. When I thought about dying someday, it was with regret that I might not live to see Edie go to Mars, or to accomplish whatever other big thing she wanted to do. But now I don't have any of those regrets, because it isn't going to happen. Even 3 years ago, I wouldn't have said that. I'd still have said, damn it, there's hope. Freedom is just common sense. We'll win. But some of the things that have happened in the last couple of years make that all different. No, don't say things that have happened. They didn't just happen. People in government did them to us on purpose. And in the last couple of years, they finally did what they'd been moving toward for a long time. They passed the laws that just plain make us slaves. They did it, and hardly anybody's even talking about it. That's what amazes me. For one thing, they passed a law that makes our driver's licenses into national ID cards. They're doing it right now, while we sit here talking. A year or two after I'm gone, all you people who are left are all going to have to carry around cards with all your numbers and fingerprints and retinal scans and personal data coded on them. The law says so. You won't be able to cash a check or get a passport without supplying your biometric data to the government or the bank. I thought it was some big conspiracy story when I first heard it, but it's true, and it's happening. And where are all the people screaming to stop it? And they've now got this database that everybody who gets a job gets put into, some national database in some big stone building in Washington where they'll know where everybody works all the time. They said it was to track deadbeat dads. Yeah. Then why are they going to put Edie and my other daughter, Pat, and everybody else into it? Since when are they, or you, or I, deadbeat dads? Along these same lines, they've even got what they call pilot programs to make people get permission from the federal government before they can get jobs. Employers in these pilot programs have to get scanners to let the federal government check people's social security numbers before they can hire anybody. Isn't that just great? Some bureaucrat in the Social Security Administration or someplace else gets to decide whether you can work or not. And this other database, all your medical records are going to go into some other big stone building in Washington. That's going to be online about the time I go too. And the old bureaucrat who wants to look at them can see them. You can't, of course, but they can. All this stuff is real. It's not in some novel about the future or in some right-wingy pamphlet. It's the law. It's in America right now. They did it all in the last couple of years, mostly by sneaking a paragraph or a page into bigger laws when nobody was looking. And what's all this about? Is it really to help welfare moms or to keep illegal immigrants from taking other people's jobs? Oh, come on. This is about one thing. It's about slavery. They give you a citizen registration number shortly after birth. As soon as you get old enough to start moving around, doing things, and making decisions on your own, they make sure that they're in a position to know every move you make, to record every transaction, to examine your whole life's record anytime some bureaucrat gets curious. They not only want to know where you are at any given moment, where you're working and living and banking, but to make sure you can't work someplace if they don't want you to. And they even want to be able to check up on your health. Now that one seems especially silly. I mean, why should some bureaucrat in Washington give a hoot about how some woman's pregnancy is going, or whether some man is boozing it up a little more than he should, or whether a middle-aged lady is dying of cancer or not? What business is it of theirs? And why should they even want to bother? But it makes sense when you realize what they're really doing. After all, if you own animals, of course you want to make sure your property has got all its vaccinations, is producing healthy offspring, and isn't being overfed or something. It's just like a modern-day farmer keeping track of his cows or pigs on his computer. You want to know they're healthy and whether they're producing as much as they can for you, so you track them. Track everything about them. They belong to you, after all. If you're a kindly, efficient farmer, of course, you want to watch over your livestock. There have been a lot of bad laws passed in my lifetime, Claire. Sometimes I thought, this is just the worst. The worst. It can't get any more horrible than this. But these laws that authorized all this tracking are really the final thing. They're the declaration that the people in Washington own us. That's all. They're plain and simply saying we're their property. There are going to be a lot more bad laws. Yeah. Really bad ones that will follow these and will be possible because of these. But before this, the bad laws were passed against free people. After this, the laws are passed to control slaves. Neither of my girls has children yet. Like every mother, I always wanted them to get going and do it, you know. I wanted my grandbabies. Now, believe me, I had to bite my lip a lot to keep from nagging them about it, like some mothers do. But to be absolutely honest, now I wish neither one of them would have children. I don't think Edie will. We've talked about this. She's a lot like me in some ways, and I think she won't bring a child into a country like this one is becoming. Now my other daughter, we always called her Practical Patty, probably will have children someday. I've kind of given Patty short shrift in talking about all this. She was the sort of daughter who never gave any trouble and was more interested in doing well in band and glee club than in thinking about all the heavy things. Her big dreams were just of having a nice little job someday, then getting married to a decent sort of guy, having a nice house, and yeah, children. So all this won't affect Patty as much as it will Edie, or as much as it would have affected me if I'd have lived to see it all come to fruition. To Patty's mind, it isn't sensible to worry about things like this. So Patty will have children, and I can only hope that at least their lives will be comfortable if they can't be free. Maybe they'll be well-fed, well-cared-for little citizens, and maybe I should hope they turn out to be the kind of people who don't think or question too much. Because if they're the other kind, like me or Edie, their lives will be miserable. The next step, you know, after getting ownership of your slaves or cows, is to call out the ones that don't fit the mold, that make trouble, or that don't produce the way you want them to. If you aren't nice, the Social Security Administration can just lose your records, or the health care people can just fiddle your medical history around so you look like a mental case. Then they can help you to death. So I guess for that reason, I should hope those grandbabies I won't live to see are quiet, obedient sheep. But damn it, if there are grandbabies, I hope they'll be as stubborn and free-thinking as their Aunt Edie, and that they'll find a better way of fighting for freedom than their Grandma Deb ever could. Let their lives be worth something deep and true, not just the worth of good livestock or laborers. If they fight, maybe they won't live happily or long. But if they have to live at all, I hope those little kids live bravely, in spite of all the odds against them. The poor souls. Do you remember the hymn, The Old Rugged Cross? It's been on my mind a lot since I got the verdict. When I was little, I thought it was such a beautiful song. I knew it was partly about dying and about being at peace in dying because of the singer's beliefs, but I didn't completely understand it. There was this line, "Till my trophies at last I lay down." I knew it meant when I die, but since I didn't have any trophies and couldn't figure out what giving up awards had to do with dying, I put my own little girl interpretation on it. I figured the word had to be trophis, and that it was some fancy adult word meaning body. Well, Claire, I'll tell you. In a year or so, when I lay this middle-aged trophis down for the last time, I won't have any regrets for myself. On the day I die, I'll be able to say, I've done all I could. I tried, even though most of what I did turned out to be misguided and ineffective. And even though I'd try something different and a lot less nice, if I could do it over again. I won't regret leaving the world the politicians just created. I don't want to see it. I don't want to live in it. But my grandbabies will be born as slaves, and oh God, I regret that. And I regret not being around to protect them. This from Greenville, South Carolina. April 6th is the deadline. A South Carolina legislative committee formed almost 40 years ago worked hard to identify communists during the Cold War and discouraged communist activity as recently as this decade. However, very little is known about the panel, which also may have targeted civil rights organizers because its records seem to have disappeared. You check all over the country, folks. Most states had legislative committees which tried to identify communists working in this country to subvert the government. And when you find that they did exist, try finding the records. This is not the only case. All of the records of communist subversive activities and the names of communists working in this country are disappearing all over the United States. Why? Because the communists are now in charge. Their infiltration, their years of work toward the great plan, toward the completion of the great work, has been successful. And the most successful operation that they ever had was when they went after Joseph McCarthy, who was right, by the way. And the opening up of the records of the KGB showed that not only was he right, but he knew the exact number of communists who had infiltrated our government at that time, and the figure that he quoted in Congress was the exact number matched in the records of the KGB. When they vilified Joseph McCarthy and made anyone who attempted to investigate and disclose and identify communists working subversively against our government in this country as McCarthyites and vilified them, they effectively stopped all attempts to investigate and identify communist activity within the United States of America, and that is what enabled them to be victorious. Because nobody wanted to be labeled a McCarthyite, except William Cooper and a few other lonely souls who really don't give a damn what anybody think about us. All we care about is freedom, like the woman in the letter that I just read to you, who is dying. Now that she's dying, she's really thinking about freedom, but not for herself, because she's going to take the trip into the ultimate freedom. She's worried about her grandchildren and her daughters, who will still be here. Why is it that so many people are so afraid? Heck, I'm part Native American and my wife is Chinese. And they have called me a white supremacist in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, on television. Jesse Jackson has said it in his speeches. It's a lie, but they say it, and it makes people tremble with fear that somebody will label them as a white supremacist. Well, I'm not afraid of it. They can label me all they want. Anything they want, I will continue to fight for freedom. They've also called me an anti-Semite, which is also another lie. They will label us anything that they possibly can in order to intimidate us, to get us to stop fighting against them so that they may enslave us peacefully without resistance. I watched so-called adults cringe and run for cover when anybody even suggested that what they're doing might be interpreted as anti-Semitic or white supremacist or extremist or fundamentalist Christian or, dread the word, constitutionalist. Why that should scare any American, I don't know, for the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, which restricts government and protects the rights of every individual. But you see, Americans have been so brainwashed and propagandized, they don't even know it. Now, if you're a constitutionist, or even worse,
if you recognize the common law, oh my God, these are terrorists.
Oh my goodness. I feel sorry for most of you. Deep, way down deep inside, I feel this tremendous sorrow because I know what travails you are going to go through because of your ignorance and your apathy and your failure to act, your fear. And I'm going to tell you something else. Almost all Americans are now so afraid of the federal government that it is the greatest proof ever needed in this country that the federal government is now a tyrant. You see, because in the America that I grew up in, that could never be. No one was afraid of the government. Ever, for any reason, no matter what kind of life they had or who they were, no one was ever afraid of the government, but now everyone is. That should be the greatest proof that you would ever need in your own experience to tell you that something is so wrong that we're not living in America anymore. We're living in some foreign country. It may look like America. You may look around and see what appear to be Americans all around you. But it's just not so, ladies and gentlemen. It's not so at all. New York law enforcement authorities are testing new security technology that is expected to lead to devices that will allow police to spot people on the street carrying concealed weapons, the New York Times reported today. Justice Department officials hailed the new device, saying they could save many lives. Quote, if you think the situation cops face day in and day out, the greatest risk is approaching a subject who may be armed. Jeremy Travis, director of the National Institute of Justice, the department research arm, told the Times. So to be able to know in advance whether the individual is armed gives the officer a tremendous advantage in safety and tactics. Listen to this. The devices use X-rays, ultrasound imaging, are computer-assisted metal detectors. They could also be used to enhance security in courthouses, prisons, schools, and airports. Highly sensitive weapons detectors are being installed for final testing at a prison in North Carolina and a federal courthouse in Los Angeles, the newspaper reported. One device that is close to being operational employs very low doses of backscattered X-rays, equivalent to about 5 minutes of exposure to the sun at sea level. The rays are reflected off the skin and used to develop in less than a second an electronic image of the body and everything the person is carrying, according to the report. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, whoever is watching these scanners as you walk by is going to see you stark naked. Is going to see everything in your pockets, everything that you have, every wound, every bandage, every colostomy sack. And do you think the Constitution's still in effect? Read the Fourth Amendment of the Bill of Rights. And then tell me that again. Now listen to this. This makes me sick, makes me want to puke. It's just a part of the great lack of morals and ethics that pervade this country. And if it starts with the highest, why should anybody else have morals or ethics? Well, I know the answer to that, simply because it's the right thing to do. But you see, most people won't answer that question that way. They'll say, well, if the Senate can do it, why can't I be a crook too? Why can't I lie and cheat and deceive and steal from people? Washington, D.C. Did you know the United States Senate spends over $200,000 in 6 months on flags? On flags? Well, what are these flags for, folks? Well, let me tell you what it's for. You see, senators want an awful lot of American flags to pass out to voters, and the House of Representatives does the same thing. But this just concentrates on the Senate. And if you remember that there's only 200 senators, or excuse me, there's two from each state, there's only 100 senators, ladies and gentlemen, and that there are over 500 representatives in the House of Representatives, the Senate actually is the lesser of the two evils. But a vote for the lesser of two evils is still a vote for evil. So listen to this. Senators want lots of American flags to pass out to voters. Flags that have flown over the Capitol. In fact, they're in such demand that Congress has turned them into an industry. Never mind that the industry is a fraud. You see, they have this little bitty flagpole just out of sight on the Capitol roof where nobody can see it. And they have hired people whose only job is to zip flags up and down this flagpole as quickly as they can, sometimes over 3,000 flags a day, so that they can tell the people that they give these flags to that it flew over the Capitol, Washington, D.C., the United States of America. It's a lie. It's a fraud. It's a scam. And we're paying for this. And every senator and every representative who does it knows it's a lie, a fraud, and a scam. They got some guys on the roof, and I'll bet you they get lazy every once in a while. They probably take the flag out, shake it, throw it back in the box, and go downstairs and say, yeah, we ran it up the flagpole. If I know human nature, I'll bet you that's exactly what happens. And even if they did run it up the flagpole and right back down real quick, it did not fly over the Capitol. Not like people believe that they are getting the flag that actually flew during a day over the Capitol of Washington, D.C. This stinks. It sucks, if you want to know the truth, just like William Jefferson Clinton sucks. Just like socialism sucks. Just like socialists suck. They just suck as much as they can out of everybody they can suck it out of. Do you know that for both the House and the Senate, this little fraud, scam, deception is estimated to cost in excess of $2 million a year? You think the senators pay for it? Not on your life. They don't have anything that we didn't give them in the first place, including their salary, even if they did pay for it, but they don't. We pay for it. We, the stupid cattle out here. You see, sometimes they're absolutely right about us. Sickening. And that's just one little thing. I mean, if I wanted to spend, 6 months just talking about the wastes in Washington, D.C. like this, I'm not talking about pork. I'm talking about absolute stupid waste. It would be easy. And when I was done after 6 months of 2 hours of broadcast every day, 5 days a week, I would not be finished. This is for all of you who actually believe that technology has reached a point where you can't fight it. That's baloney. We learned from Somalia and in Afghanistan that people who believe in what they're doing and are willing to die for it can defeat the greatest armies in the world, the greatest technologies that exist upon the face of this earth, with little or nothing. Now, I'm not grandizing or making heroes out of these two people that I'm going to tell you about, because I don't believe that murderers should get away without being punished. But I'm going to let you know what these people are doing. in the face of the technology that's trying to capture them and have been unsuccessful, so that you won't be so afraid to fight this new world order, because you're going to have to fight it, or you got a choice. You either fight it or you reach down and put the chains on your own ankles and march into the slave pool. That's your choice. Me, I made mine a long time ago. I'm either going to fight and win back my freedom for myself and my family, or I'm going to be killed and reach the ultimate freedom, but I am not ever going to be a slave. That's the choice you have to make. I'm not going to tell you what choice to make. Most of you will choose slavery, because most of you are cowards, and that's the truth. You don't want to hear it ever, but it's the truth. And that's why this broadcast is so disturbing to so many of you, is because I tell you the truth. I don't spare your feelings. We're past that point. We're past the point where I can get on the air and say that you're the greatest, most wonderful, most caring, smartest, toughest, bravest individuals that live on the face of this earth. Now, you can get that from Bobo and all those other clowns who want to tell you that kind of stuff so that you'll like them. Me, I want you to know reality. I want you to learn to deal with reality. I want you to understand the truth so that we'll have some hope of recovering our freedom. I don't care whether you like me or not. I care about freedom for me, for my family, for my children, and for you. Whether you care enough about yourself to care that much about freedom, I care that much about freedom for you. On a cold, clear Sunday in the Ozark Hills, authorities kept warm by shuffling their feet and burying their hands in their pockets, waiting for fugitive Alice Ben Johns to show his face. He refused. It's been more than a week since anyone in law enforcement has seen the suspected killer. However, with strong new evidence popping up inside a secured zone of something county, police said Johns, 36, is still in the area. One sign that comforts police: no stolen cars or boats. Now, what's unusual about this, ladies and gentlemen, is that this man has a woman with him. He has no technology with him, just him and this woman. And they're running these people ragged who have the greatest collection of technology being used to search for people that exist. They have helicopters, forward-looking infrared. They have night vision scopes. They have secured the area where they believe these people are. And they have found evidence that they're still in that area, but they are unable to see them or capture them. And all of those of you who know that you're going to fight for your freedom, that should be some comfort. To those of you who thought you had to be so afraid of all this technology, that should make you think again. But if you really want to know the truth, look what happened in Somalia and in Afghanistan and in countless other places where people wearing rags and carrying old, old rifles and using CB radios or no communications at all, maybe even signal mirrors, have defeated the greatest armies on the face of this earth. And that should tell you that anyone who really believes they're going to enslave the American people and fight those of us who are going to fight and win are playing a fool's game, because it may take us 15 or 20 years, but we will reinstate freedom in this country once it's gone. We will. It is our duty. Most of us are sworn to protect and defend the Constitution for the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. We have pledged our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
Sacred armor?
That's right. Most of you don't even know what it is. So I won't bore you with any discussion of such a thing. Los Angeles. President Clinton, after having sold America to the communist Chinese and who knows who else, the Germans, for one thing, is preparing to ask Congress for sweeping fast-track authority to negotiate a broad array of new trade agreements, despite congressional anger over his handling of trade with Mexico and China. Oh, can you believe the audacity? And you know what? I'll bet he's going to get away with it. You know why? Because I don't think too many people care. And because the Senate and the House of Representatives are made up of people who have turned traitor years ago for the most part. And if they have it, they have no power. And if they go against their party leadership or the leadership of the Senate or the House, they are stripped of their staff and their comfortable office and given a little closet somewhere with one phone and no research assistants, and they are not recognized on the floor of the House or the Senate and are never allowed to speak. Didn't you know that, ladies and gentlemen? So you can look for that to become fact. Everybody keeps talking about President Clinton's going to get impeached. Don't count on it. See, unless you can find that he has committed a crime and can prove it, and then can convince the Congress, there's not going to be any impeachment. And if you think you're going to run around and by convincing your local state legislators stop this New World Order, that also is a fool's game. They've gone too far. You heard Clinton in his inaugural address. He gave the timetable. And he said that we're all going to watch the sun set and prepare the children for the new dawn. Now, for those of you who don't understand the symbology of the New World Order, that means the old order is history. History. They're going to flush the Constitution and freedom right down the toilet. And they're going to greet the new age with a new world order. A one world totalitarian socialist, what they call utopian government, where they will present us with a Messiah who will appear to the people to be the leader, but in the shadows there will be a council of what they call wise men, so that if they do something that invokes the ire of the people, they will take it out on the presented Messiah. But the council of wise men will continue indefinitely and even forever, is their plan. I've studied them, ladies and gentlemen, now I'd say for about 23 years. And there isn't much that I don't know about them at this point. In any case, don't believe what I say or what anybody else says or what you read anywhere. Check it out. Find it for yourself. And discover whether it's the truth or not. Or you can just wait around long enough and you'll find out that I'm right. Because I am. So don't go away. This is the voice of freedom. Thank you. listening. Freedom Radio Network, broadcasting on satellite GE1, transponder 7, 7.56 audio, and over 700 FM stations across the nation and around the world.
This is my daddy's station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM, Eager.
101.1 FM is owned and operated by the Independence Foundation Trust as a nonprofit community service.
Welcome back to the Hour of the Time, folks. I'm William Cooper, the man that William Jefferson Clinton named in a White House memo as the most dangerous radio host in America. And as you listen to this broadcast, you quickly discover why. Socialists hate my guts. A lot of people who claim they're not socialists hate my guts because I tell them the truth. The truth is something no one wants to hear. I don't care who it is, because everybody is living in some kind of fantasy world with an agenda that does not suit freedom. And I'm not standing for it any longer. Well, Clinton has sold out the nation to the communist Chinese. It's not conjecture. It's fact, ladies and gentlemen. And he did it for campaign funds to get himself reelected. He sold out cheap. Real cheap. Because he sucks and he's cheap. That's why. Communist Chinese are now in Savannah, Georgia, Pascagoula, Mississippi, Beaumont, Texas, Corpus Christi. They're at both ends of the Panama Canal. They're going to be in Long Beach, California, unless someone can stop that. They're in Redwood City, California. These are all harbors. They're all excellent all-weather ports with modern interstate highways within short distance and temperate climates. What does it all mean? Well, you'll find out. We'll talk more about it on other days. And we have talked about it extensively in the past. We have warned you that this was going to happen. And you have called us fanatics and right-wing extremists and conspiracy theorists. Why is it that you folks, when you call us these things and you see that what we predict and tell you is going to happen actually happens, why haven't you got the guts to call up and say, hey, I'm sorry. What can I do to help? Why can't you do that? Why do you continue to look for the next thing we say so that you can call us all those names again? And then turn around and say that you care about freedom and that you really believe in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and in America when you've never even read the document in your whole life. I think it's time that a lot of people sat down and had a very serious talk with themselves. You need to do that. Or stop all this nonsense, admit that you're the coward that you are, put the chains on your own ankles, march into the New World Order, and let the rest of us alone. You see, if we could function without all your static, we might be able to free you someday. Lord knows, I don't know why we would ever want to free you someday after all the trouble you've caused us, but that's our nature, I guess, because we will do it if we can. And we won't even hold it against you. Never have in our history. Never will. Did you know that the financial status of every American who is on Social Security or who has a Social Security number is now available on the Internet by looking up Social Security records? That means if you have a Social Security number, I can go on the Internet in 5 minutes and look up your entire financial history on the Internet. It's open to anybody who wants to look. And it's posted there by the Social Security Administration, who tells you that your records are private and gives you a hassle and static when you want to find out the status of your own Social Security account. But anybody else can sign on the Internet and get anything they want without filling out forms, without the hassle, without some smart-ass remarks from some petty little bureaucrat clerk who makes almost nothing but has a little bit of power and wants to make your life miserable. Here's part two of the occult history of the Third Reich. Take notes. The Nazis were socialists, and socialists are Nazis, and Nazis are coming back. In fact, they're in control now. And if you think what Hitler did was bad, wait till you see what these scum have in plan for you. The best way to learn about what's happening is to learn about history. He who fails to learn from history is doomed to repeat it. Listen to this and you will see the connections and the same things happening today in this country and all over the world. So pay close attention, folks. Part two. The occult history of the Third Reich. And here it is.
the Berghof mountain retreat of Adolf Hitler. Here, senior party members and their families relax away from the frantic activity of the capital. Yet, even in the peaceful setting of the Bavarian Alps, amongst the tranquil scenes of domestic life, there is an unsettling presence, the racial elite of the new order, the SS. Arrest racial decay, asks Adolf Hitler. Shall we form a select company of the truly initiated? An order, the Brotherhood of Templars around the Holy Grail of pure blood? By 1934, almost 10 years after its creation, the SS is in the process of becoming Hitler's Brotherhood of Templars. The hand-picked, disciplined, and fiercely loyal bodyguard of the Führer is being transformed into an Aryan elite, a mystical order dedicated to the creation of an empire. In the strange and terrifying doctrines of National Socialism, the Aryan is the race of the future. Providence has decreed that the Aryans will subjugate all other peoples. In the vanguard of the Nazi mission will be the black-clad ranks of the SS. This carefully selected elite is intended to be the stock from which will come a new and superior breed of human, the Superman, a caste of men born to rule. It is Heinrich Himmler who will forge Hitler's guard into a racial aristocracy. Under Himmler's leadership, the SS will become a state within a state. Obsessed with secrecy and bound by solemn ritual, the SS will become a force of unprecedented power and authority. The origins of this, the most sinister of all Nazi creations, do not lie in the personal visions of Heinrich Himmler or his Führer. The roots of the SS go deeper even than National Socialism itself. By 1900, the cities of Germany and Austria have changed beyond all recognition. Millions have abandoned the poverty of peasant life, the slave in the mills and foundries of the Industrial Revolution. As their populations swell with the influx of labor, elegant centers of commercial and aristocratic life become teeming industrial slums. It is in the cities that the values of the old order are challenged. Calls for democracy and socialism threaten the traditional power of the ruling elites. Established religious beliefs are undermined by science and a rising tide of materialism. To many, the new world seems fractured and chaotic. Amongst the aristocratic and educated classes in the first decade of the 20th century, the overriding mood is one of nostalgia. There is a powerful yearning for a vanished past, a past believed to have been more harmonious, orderly, and spiritual. All over industrialized Europe, new movements arise, devoted to the search for simplicity. In Germany, the movement calls itself Lebensreform, life reform. It is pledged to the restoration of a more natural way of living. Tens of thousands of German youth join the Wandervogel, the birds of passage. Its members share a mystical love of the German countryside and revere German folklore and ritual. While science and medicine are rejected as products of the Industrial Revolution, vegetarianism, herbal healing, nudism, communal living and meditation become fashionable pursuits. In every major city, cults devoted to spiritualism, astrology, magic, and the occult flourish among the disciples of life reform. Of all the doctrines favored by the movement, none will be more influential than those preached by the Russian adventuress and telepath, Madame Helena Blavatsky. In 1888, Madame Blavatsky claimed to have traveled to Tibet and there to have been initiated into the secrets of spiritual masters she calls the Hidden Elect. In the doctrines of occultists, the Hidden Elect, or the Great White Brotherhood, are believed to be humans who, by initiation and self-denial, have risen to become adepts. They have gained powers and knowledge beyond those of ordinary mortals. In Britain, Aleister Crowley, a magician of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, claimed in 1909 to have crossed the abyss and to have returned as an adept. Madame Blavatsky did not claim to be an adept in her own right, but she did claim constant telepathic communication with her hidden masters. They had revealed to her, their chosen one, the occult history of the human race. According to Madame Blavatsky, each round of the cosmic cycle has associated with it seven root races. The first root race to evolve on Earth she calls the astral race. It was a race of pure spirit, the highest form of existence. The second race she calls the Hyperborean race. Its home was a now vanished continent in the Northern Ocean. The third race was the Lemurians. Blavatsky is clear about the reason for the fall of the Lemurian race. It had interbred with animals. The fourth race in the history revealed to Madame Blavatsky is the race of Atlantis. The Atlanteans had possessed psychic powers and had constructed giant cities using an energy source of mysterious origins. The Atlanteans were destroyed in a great flood. The fifth root race Madame Blavatsky sees as the race of hope. The race that had once founded the culture of ancient Greece and soon would return man to the pinnacle of spirituality. That race she named the Aryan. By 1914, Blavatsky's mystical doctrine of the destiny of Aryan man has spread throughout Germany and Austria. Days of the Great War. There is little sense of impending cataclysm. All over Europe, news of war is greeted with unqualified enthusiasm. In all the warring nations, the emotions of militant nationalism are given free rein. In the ranks of the Austrian and German armies, there is a widespread belief that the aspirations of a generation may be satisfied at last. The unification of German-speaking peoples and the creation of a Germanic empire. To the frontline soldiers of the Imperial armies, the teachings of the Austrian clairvoyant Guido von Liszt are an inspiration. Liszt believes that in the Germans, more than in any other people, runs the blood of the mythical race called by Madame Blavatsky the Aryans. To Liszt, the Great War is proof that the modern world, with its materialism and its democracy, is destroying itself. But out of war and destruction will come the victory of the German cause and the beginning of an Aryan millennium. Liszt revives the prayer of the 16th century philosopher and heretic Giordano Bruno. O Jove, let the Germans realize their own strength, and they shall not be men, but gods. Like Aleister Crowley and Madame Blavatsky, this psychic researcher's had led him to believe in the existence of a hidden elect. His visions of the ancient German tribes had revealed to him an elite class of priest rulers. List calls it the Amanenschaft. The role of the Amanenschaft was to preserve the occult knowledge of the Germans' Aryan ancestors. List claims that the imposition of Christianity on the Teutonic tribes and the persecution of the followers of the old religion forced the Amanenschaft to continue its traditions in secret. Their lore had lived on in the rituals and symbols of a network of secret societies. The store of occult knowledge had been preserved down the centuries by Freemasons, Rosicrucians, and chivalrous orders such as the Knights Templar. So great is List's influence among German and German-Austrian nationalists that many army officers have joined the secret occultist organization inspired by his teachings. The German Order, founded in May 1912, has lodges in 10 German cities. The government of the Order is by a secret 12-man council of initiates, calling itself the Armanist Assembly. The future Aryan Empire will, according to List, be governed by a similar council of initiates, a new Amanenschaft. In the design of the future SS, List's Armanist Assembly will not be forgotten. List's prediction that the Great War would see the victory of Imperial Germany over its democratic and degenerate enemies will not be fulfilled. By 1918, the German economy is in ruins and the Kaiser's armies are crumbling. To the men at the front, the failure of the Imperial war machine is inexplicable. In 1918, Germany had won several major battles. The Russian enemy had already collapsed. Theories of a conspiracy abound. Many believe that Germany has been betrayed from within. The blame is placed squarely on the shoulders of the traditional targets of the German nationalist movements: capitalists, Democrats, and Jews. To the followers of Guido von List, all that is valuable seems irretrievably lost. A government of unknown politicians has accepted the humiliating terms of the Versailles Treaty. Worst of all, the Kaiser and the German princes have abdicated. Germany has become a democratic republic. The abdication of the Kaiser is a stunning blow to the occultists of the German order. Guido von List had taught that the aristocracy of Germany had been founded in ancient times by the Amanenschaft itself. In the aristocracy was to be found the purest of Aryan blood, and with it the strongest remaining traces of the Aryan psychic powers. In the aftermath of the Great War, faced with the twin threat of democracy and socialism, traditionalists eagerly embraced List's mystical belief in the German nobility. But by now, a new concept of aristocracy is in the process of development. Side by side with the teachings of List, it will become the cornerstone of Nazi ideology and the future SS. Since the mid-19th century, the evolutionary theories of Charles Darwin had challenged religious beliefs held sacred for centuries. But by the end of the Great War, many physicians, scientists, and politicians have come to see in Darwinism a formula for social and political action. Belief in the equality of man is seen as simply unscientific. The new slogan is, "The survival of the fittest." In Darwin's The Descent of Man, published in 1871, he speculates on the effect of modern medicine on the future course of human evolution. With savages, the weak in body or mind are soon eliminated. We civilized men, on the other hand, do our best to check the process of elimination. Thus, the weak members of civilized society propagate their kind.
This, argues Darwin, must be highly injurious to the race of man. Excepting in the case of man himself, hardly anyone is so ignorant as to allow his worst animals to breed. In Britain, the family planning movement, led by the scientist Marie Stopes, is preoccupied with the supposed threat to the health of the race posed by uncontrolled breeding. Marie Stopes' work on birth control, Wise Parenthood, first published in 1918, is dedicated to all those who wish to see our race grow in strength and beauty. Stopes is concerned with the tendency revealed by the national census for the lower classes to produce more children than the upper classes. The numbers of our population, she states, increasingly tend to be made up from the less thrifty and the less conscientious. In America, the compulsory sterilization of the mentally handicapped, of alcoholics, and of persistent criminals has been legal in certain states since 1907. Marie Stopes advocates similar policies for Britain, including the sterilization of male children with an epileptic or mentally handicapped parent, uncle or aunt. The family planning movement is part of a broader movement aimed at directing and accelerating the evolution of the human race by selective breeding. This new science calls itself eugenics. By 1918, eugenics has become so influential that the British Medical Journal publishes an article in which a noted physician can write, "There is no equality in nature among children nor among adults. And if there is to be a much-needed improvement in the race, we must breed from the physically, morally, and intellectually fit." From Britain, eugenics spreads to Germany, acquiring the new name racial hygiene. University departments and institutes are founded devoted to the new science. By the 1920s, eugenics has won widespread support amongst the German medical establishment. It has also had a profound effect on the doctrines of the German occultists. In 1919, Guido von Liss, a prophet of the Aryan millennium, dies in Berlin at the age of 70. His place as Germany's leading mystic and Aryan visionary has been taken by Jörg Lanz. Lanz, an ex-Cistercian monk and respected biblical scholar, will have a profound impact on the development of Nazi ideology and on the structure and ritual of the future SS. Lanz has blended the Aryan occultism of Guido von Liszt and the principles of the science of eugenics. He calls his new doctrine theozoology. Theozoology is an occult religion of race. Inspired by Madame Blavatsky's mystical history of racial evolution, Lanz claims that the decline of the Aryans occurred because they had committed bestiality with a subhuman species. The result was the creation of many mixed races, races whose very existence threatens the rightful dominance of the Aryans. Like Liszt, Lanz believed that the early Aryans possessed the power of telepathy. Interbreeding with racial inferiors had led to the loss of their paranormal abilities. "Why do you seek a hell in the next world?" Lanz asks. "Is not the hell in which we live and which burns inside us sufficiently dreadful?" To Lanz, the hell which burns inside is the impure blood in the veins of even the purest of Aryans. The teachings of Jörg Lanz are propagated throughout Germany and Austria by his own journal, Ostara, founded in 1905. Lance claims that over 100,000 copies of Ostara a year are sold. He even claims that amongst his eminent subscribers is the British general Kitchener. In the pages of Ostara, and in a series of widely read essays, Lance develops a terrifying prescription for the purification of the race. He proposes polygamy to increase the birth rate of the racially purest. Eugenic convents are to be established, in which chosen women he calls brood mothers will produce children for pure-blooded Aryan males. While the racially impure and the physically or mentally unfit are to be sterilized, other races deemed inferior are to be deported to Madagascar or used as slave labor. In the future Nazi state, all of Lance's proposals will be given the most serious consideration. Some will be put into practice. A massive compulsory sterilization campaign will be directed at those judged physically, mentally, or racially inferior. The deportation of German Jews to Madagascar will be discussed in the upper echelons of the party. The SS will plan for the official introduction of polygamy and will found its own SS breeding program. To Jörg Lutz, the legends of the Knights of the Holy Grail are more than the products of the medieval imagination. Lance believed that they were the Knights Templar, founded in the 12th century and famed for their part in the Christian Crusades. Lance believed that the Crusades were an attempt to hold back the inferior races of the East. The Holy Grail was an electrical force representing the psychic powers of the pure-blooded Aryans. The search for the Grail was the search for racial purity. In 1907, Lance formed an occult society dedicated to a new crusade. He called it the Order of the New Templars. In the castle of Burg Wertenstein in Upper Austria, Lance founded the order's first headquarters. Other order priories soon follow. The occult rituals of the New Templars are based on Lance's monastic experience and his own specially composed psalms, prayers, and readings. A constant theme is an appeal to the Aryan Christ Freyja for salvation from racial impurity and for the extermination of inferior races. The aims of the order are explicit: to harmonize science, art, and ethics into an occult religion, devoted to the purification of the Aryan race in all countries of the world. In anticipation of the practices of the SS, prospective members and their marriages are racially vetted. For Lance, the New Templars are the beginning of a new order. No longer will parliaments determine the fate of the people, Lance proclaims. In their place will rule wise priest kings and leaders of chivalrous and spiritual secret orders. In reality, it will not be the occultists of the New Templars who will create the Aryan aristocracy of the future. The mystical doctrines preached by Lance will be put into practice by others, above all, by a man who since the age of 20 has been an avid collector of Ostara. In the closing months of 1918, Corporal Adolf Hitler, holder of the Iron Cross First Class, will come to the attention of his superior officers. A near mutiny at the demobilization camp at which Hitler is stationed is brought under control by his powerful oratory. In September 1919, Hitler, now a civilian, is called upon once more by the army command. This time, to spy on an insignificant nationalist group calling itself the German Workers' Party. Within months, Hitler has joined the party and has begun to speak at meetings. By January 1920, he has been elected head of propaganda and has drawn up a new party constitution. The army intelligence captain who had first recruited Hitler as a spy has been retired. His replacement as Hitler's army sponsor is the 32-year-old Captain Ernst Röhm. Röhm is held in high regard as a courageous frontline officer and an outstanding organizer. The Bavarian Army Command has given Röhm the task of circumventing the arms restrictions imposed by the Treaty of Versailles. He is to establish secret arms dumps and organize the many nationalist paramilitary groups in Bavaria into an unofficial army reserve. One such group of irregulars is the powerful force commanded by ex-naval captain Hermann Erhardt. The Erhardt Brigade has played a major role in combating socialist revolution in Bavaria. It is Ernst Röhm who brings together Erhardt and Adolf Hitler. Public meetings of the early Nazi party are defended by stewards known as the Athletics and Sports Detachment. In the summer of 1921, Ernst Röhm arranges that officers of the Erhardt Brigade should become the commanders of a new party defense force, the SA Storm Detachment. To Adolf Hitler and the Nazi party, the function of the SA is to protect party speakers and make an impressive show of force when the occasion demands. But the SA has another role. It is an unofficial part of the German army. It is trained by army officers, numbered in army mobilization plans, and controlled by Röhm and Erhardt. Hitler is well aware that the allegiance of the SA does not lie with him or with the party. He knows that as party leader, he needs a force upon which he can rely utterly. The shock troop Hitler is the prototype for the SS. November 1923. Adolf Hitler is jailed for his part in an attempt to overthrow the government of Bavaria. The Nazi party and the SA are banned. Hitler's shock troop bodyguard is scattered. During his imprisonment, Hitler writes his political testament, Mein Kampf, and ponders the future of the party and of the SA. It is clear that eventually he must revive the SA, but he must also reform and strengthen his own personal guard. Hitler's requirements for his new force are clear. I told myself then that I needed a bodyguard, even a very restricted one, but made up of men ready to march against their own brothers. On December the 20th, 1924, Hitler is released from prison. He has served only 9 months of a 5-year sentence, but his trial and imprisonment have made him a national figure. 2 months after his release, Hitler formally reconstitutes the Nazi party and reforms the SA under a new commander. Röhm and Hitler have argued and parted company. In April 1925, Hitler orders his chauffeur and ex-bodyguard, Julius Schreck, to form a new force for the defense of the Führer and the protection of party headquarters. It is the Schutzstaffel Protection Squad, the SS. To set themselves apart from the SA, the SS wear black caps bearing a silver death's head insignia. To the intense irritation of the SA, the SS is soon behaving as an elite. SS entry requirements are far stricter than those of the SA. SS discipline is more severe. The SS attend all party meetings but never speak. Already, its unofficial motto is, "The aristocracy keeps its mouth shut." On July the 4th, 1926, Hitler confirms the SS as his elite organization. At the second party rally at Weimar, he gives the SS guardianship of the party's most sacred relic, the flag drenched in the blood of party fighters killed in the coup of 1923. As custodians of the blood banner, the SS are entrusted with the Nazi symbol of martyrdom in the struggle for Aryan supremacy. The transformation of the SS from the elite guard of the Führer into the mystical order it will eventually become will be the work of one man. He is Heinrich Himmler, the most enigmatic of all Nazi leaders. Himmler is a devoted follower of the Aryan occultism of Guido von Liszt and Georg Lutz. He too dreams of a Germanic empire ruled by a mystical order of the Aryan elite. He is determined that this elite should be drawn from the ranks of the SS. The Superman, the new breed of Germanic ruler, is to be created from the stock which he will select. Himmler is appointed head of the SS in January 1929. For almost a year, he and his wife have been smallholders and poultry farmers. Since early youth, Himmler has been an eager convert to the teachings of the movement for life reform. The land, he believes, is the origin of all that is good. Cities are the source of all that is unhealthy, corrupt, and immoral. The yeoman on his own acre, writes Himmler, is the background of the German people's strength and character. Himmler has long been associated with the Ottoman League, a nationalist and anti-Slavic movement of city youth committed to life on the land and the expansion of German farming to the east. The oath of the Ottoman League is sworn by blood and soil. In the Ottoman League, Himmler has met the man who will transform the oath by blood and soil into a central doctrine of the SS. To Walter Dare, an ex-official in the Prussian Ministry of Agriculture, the relationship between German blood and German soil is a source of mystical power. Questions of agriculture are not questions of economics, but of race and destiny. In 1930, Himmler's fantasies of an Aryan future are the least of Hitler's concerns. The unity of the party and Hitler's own future as its leader are under threat. With the economic depression at its height, Germany's unemployed flood into the ranks of the SA. The stormtroopers now number 100,000 men. To the radicals of the SA, National Socialism promises the destruction of the traditional German ruling classes. In the eyes of the stormtroopers, the industrialists, army officers, and aristocrats, who are the Nazi Party's most influential supporters, are no more than contemptible parasites. In protest at the political alliances which Hitler has formed, many SA commanders withdraw their men from the party's service. Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda chief, warns Hitler that a split within the SA and within the party is imminent. Hitler's solution is to recall the only man he believes capable of reuniting the SA, Ernst Röhm. Röhm will succeed in the task Hitler has set for him. He will pay for success with his life. As Röhm sets about the unification and expansion of the SA, Himmler takes a different road. His strategy is not one of rapid expansion. Instead, he concentrates on careful and systematic selection. In 1930, Himmler had won a valuable concession from Hitler. The SS would be allowed to recruit from the ranks of the SA.
Himmler proceeds to put into practice his theories of breeding. We went about it like a nursery gardener trying to reproduce a good old strain which has been adulterated and defaced. I started with a minimum height requirement. I knew that men of a certain height must somewhere possess the blood I desire. On December the 31st, 1931, Himmler establishes the SS Race and Resettlement Bureau. It is to be headed by his old friend, Walter Dare. Dare is awarded the rank of honorary SS General. The task of the Race and Resettlement Bureau is to prepare for the future colonization of the East by pure-blooded Germans. It is also instructed to conduct research into racial ancestry, biological selection, and the history of the Aryans. Its staff of leading academics and medical men are ordered by Himmler to develop stricter requirements for SS entry. Bureau physicians assess the degree of racial purity of each applicant by physical examination. Only those considered pure or predominantly Nordic are acceptable. The applicant's physique is also judged on a 9-point scale. The examiners are instructed to take into account the attitude and bearing of the candidate. Himmler has decreed, in his attitude to discipline, the man should not behave like an underling. His gait, his hands, everything should correspond to the ideal which we have set ourselves. To Himmler, selection is only the first step in his plan to reclaim the Aryan blood latent in the German people. The second stage is the control of SS breeding. The Race and Resettlement Bureau is charged with the task of racially vetting SS marriages. Prospective brides of SS men are required to prove the purity of their Aryan blood back to the year 1750. By 1933, the Bureau will be examining almost 2,000 SS marriage applications a month. It is the beginning of the largest and most terrifying eugenics experiment in human history. From 1935, the Race and Resettlement Bureau will be empowered to vet the marriages of the entire civilian population of Germany. Heinrich Himmler is so confident of success that he predicts that in 120 years, the entire German people should once more be pure-blooded Aryans. Himmler knows that the realization of his Aryan vision depends above all on the SS becoming the most powerful organization in the Nazi Party and in the German state. Already, Hitler has given the SS the role of carrying out police and intelligence duties within the party. Himmler is quick to seize the opportunity to expand his power. In 1931, Himmler recruits a 33-year-old ex-naval officer, Reinhard Heydrich, to found an SS security service. The establishment of the SD will be the first stage in Himmler's creation of an SS state within a state. In 1932, two elections for the presidency of Germany deliver to Hitler 30% of the national vote. In the July parliamentary elections, Hitler campaigns in 50 cities in the space of 2 weeks. His efforts are amply rewarded. The party wins over 13 million votes and 230 seats in the Reichstag. Hitler demands the post of Chancellor. Parliament refuses. Yet another election on November the 6th
sees the Nazi vote fall by 2 million. The communists increase their vote by almost 1 million and win 100 seats. With no party having an overall majority, the conservatives in parliament choose an alliance with the Nazis. Hitler's price for cooperation is the chancellorship. This time, he is not refused. In spite of his growing power within the party, Heinrich Himmler is not awarded a ministerial post in the new government. But the man Hitler calls my loyal Heinrich does not complain to his Führer. Himmler's ambition extends far beyond the control of a mere government department. During his youth, Himmler had spent 3 years as a student of agriculture. In the college fencing fraternity to which Himmler belonged, Jörg Lanz's occultist periodical Ostara was widely read. Of all the prophecies made by Lanz, one would become Himmler's obsession. On astrological grounds, Lanz foretold the invasion of Europe from the east. Himmler comes to believe that it is the destiny of the SS to repel the coming assault. The great battles he foresees will be a prelude to the final victory of the Aryans. Already, Himmler has identified the figure of German history who will become his idol and his inspiration. King Heinrich I, German king of the Saxons, had in the 10th century fought and conquered the Slavic tribes of the east. So great will Himmler's devotion to the king become that he will make an annual pilgrimage to Heinrich's tomb. He will believe himself the reincarnation of the king and the recipient of psychic messages from the spirit of the dead ruler. Himmler believes that his divine mission is to complete the work of King Heinrich. He will create from the SS a knightly order which will rule the coming Aryan Empire. But for a time at least, Himmler's visions of the future must take second place to practical politics. From 1933, Himmler's objective is to win control of Germany's many state police forces. The major obstacle to his ambition is Hermann Göring. Göring is now Minister President of Prussia and Chief of the Prussian Secret Police, the Gestapo. Göring sees himself as prime candidate for the job of Chief of a new unified German police force. In Göring's campaign to eliminate Prussian communists and all other opponents of National Socialism, he employs the SA as auxiliaries to the police and the Gestapo. The Berlin SA are the most brutal and the most feared stormtroop detachments in Germany. Their hatred of the middle classes almost equals their hatred of Jews and communists. But Göring is unconcerned. It is not my business to do justice, he proclaims. It is my business to annihilate and exterminate. That is all. In the capital and throughout Prussia, Göring unleashes a reign of terror in which thousands are interred in SA concentration camps. The situation is fast becoming a national scandal. The party's supporters, amongst the middle and upper classes, are outraged. Hitler is persuaded that command of a unified German police force cannot be entrusted to Göring. Himmler has won a major victory. One by one, the state police forces will fall under his control. In April 1934, Himmler wins the greatest prize of all. He succeeds in forcing Göring to hand over control of the Gestapo. Now, only one force stands between Himmler and the power he seeks. Spring 1934. Ernst Röhm, leader of the SA, conducts his own version of Hitler's flag consecration ritual. It is a sign to the 4 million strong SA of Rome's power and independence. Rome's intention is to create from the SA a new National Socialist German army with himself as its commander-in-chief. The regular army commanders become increasingly anxious. Under cover of inspecting a naval exercise, Hitler holds a secret meeting with the army generals. He gives them his assurance that in exchange for their support, the army will continue to be Germany's only military force. Hitler promises that Rome will be dealt with. The agent of his destruction is to be Himmler's SS. Himmler and his deputy, Heydrich, contrive evidence that Rome and the SA are planning a coup against Hitler. A list of the supposed conspirators is drawn up. It includes not only the leadership of the SA, but all those who have opposed the growing power of the SS. The bloodbath that Himmler unleashes on June the 30th, 1934, will become known as the Night of the Long Knives. Up to 500 will be murdered by SS executioners. The murder of the SA leadership is greeted with relief by the German army. On the death of President Hindenburg on the 2nd of August 1934 and the confirmation of Hitler as President of Germany, the army willingly changes its oath of allegiance. Loyalty is now sworn not to the German state or to the Constitution, but to Adolf Hitler himself. The true victor of the Night of the Long Knives is not the German army. It is the SS.
This is the Voice of Freedom. You're listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network, broadcasting on satellite GE1, transponder 7, 7.56 audio, and over 700 FM stations across the nation and around the world. The Hour of the Time is also carried on WRMI, Worldwide Shortwave Radio, 9955 kHz, Monday through Friday night, 5 until 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Be sure and tune in later this evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 7 Mountain Standard Time, for Michael Cunningham with Quest for Help.
This is my daddy's station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM, eager.
101.1 FM is owned and operated by the Independence Foundation Trust, as a nonprofit community service.
We now return you to our regularly scheduled programming, All Oldies, Most of the Time.